Track 9.
With an effort, Howell shrugged off the black mood of despair. Of course, you're right. This moping and complaining will profit us not at all. I have had the carpenters begin to fashion new legs for you of strong English oak, Tom told him brightly. We will have you up before you see high wheeled again. Tom sent for the head carpenter. The little gnarled Welshman brought the two peg legs, still only crudely carved, to show Howell. Then he and Tom made a show of measuring and fitting them to Howell's stumps. Howell seemed to take a lively interest and laughed with them, making fatuous suggestions. Can we not fit them with a compass and weathercock to aid my navigation? But when the carpenter had gone below, he lapsed back into his dark mood. I will never be too handy with those timber yards on my legs. I fear that you might have to go after Dorian on your own, Tom. He held up a hand to still Tom's quick protest. But I will stand by my word. You shall have all the help I can give you. 2 weeks later, while the ship lay becalmed on the edge of the sluggish Sargasso Sea at 30 degrees north latitude and 60 degrees west, Tom went down to his father's cabin in the humid calm and found him shrunken in his bunk. His skin was stretched over the bone of his skull, tight and parchment yellow like the face of the Egyptian mummy that one of Tom's ancestors had brought back from a voyage to Alexandria, and which stood in its open coffin against one of the back walls of the library at High Weald. Tom called for Dr. Reynolds and left his father in his care. Then, unable to bear the atmosphere in the stern cabin any longer, he hurried on deck and took long draughts of the warm air. "Will this voyage never end?" he lamented. "If we do not get him home soon, he will never see High Weald again. Oh, for a wind to hasten us on!" He ran to the mainmast shrouds and climbed aloft, never stopping until he reached the truck. He hung there, peering at the horizon to the north, vague and smoky with sea fret. Then he drew the dagger from the sheath on his belt and slammed it into the wood of the mast. He left it there, for Abberley had taught him that this was the way to call up the wind. He started to whistle Spanish Ladies, but that made him think of Dorian, so he changed to Greensleeves. All that morning he whistled for the wind, and before the sun had reached noon he looked back over the stern. The surface of the sea was a polished mirror, broken only by the floating clumps of yellow sargasso weed. Then he saw the dark blue line of the wind racing swiftly towards them over the shining surface. "Deck!" he yelled down. "Squall line! Dead astern!" And he saw the tiny figures of the watch on deck scramble to the sheets to trim the sails to the coming wind. It picked up all four ships of the squadron and bore them away. The Seraph was still in the van, and the yeoman, the minotaur, and the matronly lamb trailed after her. From then onwards it blew steadily out of the west, never faltering, not even during the night. Tom left his dagger pegged into the top of the mainmast. They made their landfall off the Isles of Scilly, and hailed the first sail they had seen in 2 months. It was a small open fishing boat with a crew of three. "What news?" Tom hailed them. "We have had no news for 18 months. "War!" the reply was shouted back. "War with the French!" Tom called Edward Anderson and the other captains on board the Seraph for a hasty council of war. It would be tragic to complete such a perilous voyage, and then, almost in sight of home, to fall victim to French privateers. Howell was enjoying one of his stronger periods, and lucid enough to take part in the discussions. So Tom gathered them in the stern cabin. "We have a choice," he told them. "We can dock in Plymouth, or we can run up channel for the mouth of the Thames." Anderson was for Plymouth, but Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson wanted to head for London. When each had given his opinion, Tom spoke out. "Once we are at Blackwall, we can offload our cargoes directly into the company warehouses, and our prize can be on the company auction floors within days." He looked to his father for encouragement. When Howell nodded, Tom went on. "If we go into Plymouth, we may be bottled up there for the good Lord only knows how long. I say we run the gauntlet of the French privateers and set a course to weather Northumberland." "Tom's right. The sooner we can deliver our cargo, the happier I'll be," said Howell. They stood the crews to, and with loaded cannon and double lookouts at the mastheads, they ran up channel. Twice during the days that followed, they saw strange sails that flew no colours, but had the look of Frenchies about them. Tom gave the flag signal to close up their formation, and the strangers veered off, heading back into the east, where the French coast lay just below the horizon. They raised the light on Northfallen 2 hours before dawn, and were past Sheerness by noon. In the gloaming of that winter's day, all four ships tied up at the company docks in the river. Before the gangplank was down, Tom had shouted across to the company agent, who waited on the wharf to greet them. "Send a message to Lord Childs that we have taken great prize. He must come at once." 2 hours before midnight, Childs' carriage, with the two outriders at full gallop clearing the way and the side lights glaring, came clattering through the gates of the yard. The driver reined in the team at the edge of the dock, and Childs almost tumbled from the carriage door before the wheels had stopped turning. He came stumping up the Seraph's gangplank, his face flushed, his wig awry, and his mouth working with excitement. "Who are you?" he blared at Tom. "Where is Sir Henry?" "My lord, I am Sir Henry's son, Thomas Courtney." "Where is your father, lad?" "He waits for you below, my lord." Childs swiveled around and pointed at the Minotaur. "What ship is that? She has the look of an Indiaman, but I know her not." "That's the old Minotaur, my lord, under a fresh coat of paint."
"The Minotaur? You retook her from the Corsair?"
Childs did not wait for his reply.
"That other ship beyond her."
He pointed at the Lamb.
"What ship is that?"
"Another prize, my lord. A Dutchman with a full cargo of China tea."
"Jesus love you, lad. You are a herald of great good tidings. Lead me to your father."
Hal was sitting up in the captain's chair with a velvet cloak draped across his lap to hide his injuries. He wore a dark blue velvet coat. On his chest glittered the gold and jewelled emblem of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail. Although his face was deadly pale, and his eyes sunk into dark cavities, he held himself straight and proud.
"Welcome aboard, my lord," he greeted Childs. "Please excuse me for not rising, but I am a little indisposed."
Childs seized his hand.
"You are welcome indeed, Sir Henry. I am eager to hear the extent of your successes. I have seen the two prizes tied up alongside the wharf, and your son has given me some idea of the cargo you carry."
"Please be seated." Hal indicated the chair at his side.
"My report will take some little time. I have written it all out. But I should like to tell you of our expedition, man to man and face to face. But first, a glass of wine."
He gestured to Tom to fill the glasses that stood ready on a silver tray. Childs sat forward in his chair and listened intently as Hal began his tale. Occasionally he asked a question, but mostly he listened in rapt silence as Hal read aloud the cargo manifests of the four ships of the squadron. When at last he fell silent, drained by the effort of the long recital, Childs leaned over and took the parchments from his hand. He scrutinized them carefully, his eyes shining with cupidity. At last he looked up again.
"Since the outbreak of war with the French, the price of commodities has almost doubled. With the two captured ships, the value of the prize you have won for us might be as much as £500,000. The directors of the company will be more than grateful, and I think I can speak for His Majesty when I say that the Crown will honour its solemn undertaking to you. You will be Henry Courtney, Baron Dartmouth, before the week is out."
Childs saluted him with a raised glass.
"I knew that I had chosen the right man when I sent you. May I drink to your health and fortune, Sir Henry?"
"Thank you, my lord. I am happy that you were pleased."
"Pleased!" Childs laughed. "There are no words to express the extent of my pleasure, my admiration, my amazement at your resourcefulness, your courage."
He leaned across to place his hand on Hal's knee. A comical expression of astonishment came over his face. He looked down and groped for Hal's missing limb.
"Sir Henry, I am overcome."
He looked down at Hal's lower body.
"Good God, man, your legs! You have lost your legs."
Hal smiled wanly.
"Yes, my lord, there was a certain price to pay. We seamen call it the butcher's bill." "We must get you out of this ship. You will be my guest at Bombay House while you recuperate. My carriage is on the wharf. I will call my physicians, the best in London. You will lack for nothing. I promise you that.
One of the first things Hal did after he arrived at Bombay House was write to William, giving him the momentous tidings of the prize he had taken and of his imminent elevation to the peerage. It took the letter over a week to reach his son in Devon. With the letter still in his hand, William shouted for his horse, and within the hour was riding furiously out through the gates of High Weald and galloping up the main road to London as fast as the relays of fresh horses from the post-houses could carry him. 5 days after leaving High Weald, he rode into the grounds of Bombay House in the middle of the afternoon in a downpour of rain. He left his hired horse in the stable yard. Then, soaked and muddy to the waist, he strode through the main doors, brushing aside the steward and footman who tried to bar his entrance. "I am the eldest son of Sir Henry Courtenay. I wish to be taken to my father immediately." As soon as he heard the name, one of the secretaries came hurrying forward. In the last few days, the name of Courtenay had taken the city by storm. Every news sheet had carried pages of print concerning the exploits of Sir Henry Courtenay in the ocean of the Indies. Some were wildly fanciful, yet as an item of gossip, he had supplanted the news of the latest English victory in France, and his name was bandied about every tavern and fashionable gathering in London. To add to the excitement, broadsheets handed out in the street advertised the forthcoming auction sale of the cargo and the prizes at the premises of John Company in Leadenhall Street, describing them as the greatest treasures ever taken from an enemy on the high seas. Within days of the squadron's arrival, shares in the United Company of Merchants of England trading to the East Indies, which was the full and ringing title of John Company, increased in value by over 15%. Over the past 5 years, the company had paid an annual dividend of 25%, but anticipation of the distribution of this vast treasure drove the shares to unheard-of heights. "Thank God you have arrived, sir," the secretary greeted William. "Your father has been asking for you every day. Please allow me to lead you to him." He took William up the broad, curving marble staircase. When they reached the first landing, William halted abruptly under the massive Holbein portrait of Lord Childs's great-great-grandfather and looked up at the two men descending the stairs towards him. His severe features knitted and his dark eyes glittered as he took in the younger of the pair. "Well met, brother dear. It seems my prayers are unanswered, and you have returned to plague me. You and that great black savage." He glanced at Abberley. Tom stopped on the landing, facing William. He was an inch taller now than his elder brother. He looked him up and down, starting at his muddy boots and ending at his arrogant, saturnine head, and smiled coldly. "I am deeply touched by your expression of affection. Please be assured that it has returned in full measure." Although he did not show it, William was taken aback by the transformation that the years had wrought in Tom. He had become tough and tall, full of self-confidence, a man to reckon with. "No doubt we shall have the opportunity to continue this pleasant discourse at a later date." William inclined his head in dismissal. "But now I have my duty as the firstborn to attend our father." Tom did not acknowledge the barbed reference to William's seniority of birth, although it stung. He stood aside and bowed slightly. "Your servant, brother." William swept past him and, without looking back, reached the long portrait gallery of the house. The secretary led him to the end of the passage and rapped with his cane on the double doors. They were opened immediately, and William went through into the elaborate bedchamber beyond. Four black-clad surgeons were clustered about the huge four-poster bed on its raised dais. William could tell their profession by the old bloodstains on their clothing. They opened their ranks as he approached. When he saw the figure lying on the pillows, William came to a halt. He remembered the robust and vigorous man he had seen sail away from Plymouth Harbour. This frail old fellow with silver beard, shaven head and pain-fretted features could not be the same man. "I have prayed God for your arrival," Hal whispered. "Come, kiss me, William." William started forward again and hurried to the bedside. He knelt and pressed his lips to his father's pale cheek. "I give thanks to God that he has spared you and that you are so well recovered from your wounds," William told him with a sincere and joyous mien. which disguised his true feelings. "He is dying," William thought, with a mixture of elation and alarm. "The estate is almost mine. And this famous treasure which he has brought back from his marauding. I hope you are as well as you appear," he asked, and gripped the thin, cold hand that lay on top of the brocaded bedclothes. "By Jesus," he thought, "if the old pirate dies before the investiture, the barony will be lost. Without the belt of nobility around my waist, the taste of even this great fortune he has raided from the heathen will be soured." "You are a fine and loving son, William, but don't weep for me yet. Even these fine coffin fillers," he gestured at the four eminent surgeons who surrounded his bed, "even they will be hard put to bury me." He attempted a feckless laugh, which rang hollow in the vast echoing chamber. None of the doctors smiled. "My love for you is enhanced by the pride I feel for the glory you have achieved. When will you take your seat in the Lord's, Father?" "Within the next few days," Hal answered. "And as the eldest son, you will be with me to see me honoured." "Sir Henry," one of the physicians interjected, "we do not feel that it is wise for you to visit the House of Lords in your present state of health. We are seriously concerned." William sprang to his feet and rounded on the doctor before he could finish expressing his misgivings. "Nonsense, fellow. It is plain for any fool to see that my father is strong enough to honour the summons of his sovereign lord. I shall be with him at every minute. With my own hands I shall see to his every want." 5 days later, the servants carried Hal down the staircase on a litter, with William hovering anxiously at his side. Lord Childs's carriage stood ready in front of the main doors, and Tom and Abberley stood separated from the troop of horsemen who would escort the carriage. The footman set down the litter, down next to the carriage, and there was a moment of confusion when nobody seemed certain what to do next. Tom stepped forward quickly, elbowing his elder brother aside, and before the doctors could intervene, he lifted his father easily and stepped into the carriage with the wasted body in his arms. "Father, this is not wise. You are taxing your strength with this journey," he whispered, as he settled Hal in the carriage and spread the fur rug over him. "The king may return to the continent soon to pursue the war, and who knows when next he will return to England." "Then Abberley and I should go with you," Tom pleaded, "but William has forbidden it." "William will take good care of me." Hal pulled the lustrous furs around his shoulders. "You must stay here with Walsh and take care of our interest at the auction house. I place great trust in you, Tom." Tom knew that the true reason for his refusal was that his father did not want to throw him together with his half-brother. "As you wish, Father," he acquiesced. "As soon as this business at the Lord's is done with, and the sale completed, we can go back to Highweald and make our plans for the rescue of Dorian." "I will be waiting here when you return," Tom promised him, and climbed down to stand at the rear wheel. William stepped into the carriage, settled himself in the seat beside their father. The driver whipped up the horses, and the carriage rolled out through the gates. Tom turned to Abberley. "It is bad enough that Black Billy will drag him around in that bone shaker. I will not let him do the same on the return to Highweald. The long journey down to Devon over those rough roads will kill him. We must take him by ship to Plymouth. The sea will be gentler on him, and you and I can take better care of him." "You do not have a ship, Clebby," Abberley reminded him. "The Seraph and the Minotaur belong to John Company." "Then we must find another to charter. There are French privateers in the channel. We need something small and handy, small enough not to attract their interest, and fast enough to give them the slip if they decide to chase us." "I think I know the master of such a craft," Abberley said thoughtfully, "unless things have changed in the time we have been away." The auction sale at the company's magnificent premises at Leadenhall Street took 4 days to accomplish. Tom sat beside Master Walsh throughout to note the prices bid on the booty. The main sale room was shaped like a cockpit, with tiers of benches rising up from the circular floor where the auctioneer had his dais. The benches were so crowded with merchants, their secretaries and bookkeepers, that there was not enough seats for all. Many found standing room only against the back walls, but they joined in boisterously, roaring their bids and waving their catalogues to attract the attention of the auctioneer. As Tom listened to the prices being driven up with mad abandon, he thought of the chests of coin stored in the vaults beneath the auction rooms. They had brought them up from the company wharf the night that the squadron had docked, driving the coaches through the dark cobbled streets with a guard of 50 armed seamen marched in an escort around them. It was clear that the prices Lord Childs had predicted would be far surpassed in the hysteria that surrounded the sale. Each day it continued, Tom saw his share increase in value. "Dear Lord," he marvelled on the last day, as he scribbled his calculations on his slate, "with good fortune I will take away more than £1,000. That was as much as one of the miners or farm labourers at High Weald might earn in his entire working life. He was bewildered by such dreams of wealth, until he thought of what his father's share would be worth. "Almost 100,000, he exclaimed, "together with the ermine cloak and jewelled sword belt of a baron." Then his mouth hardened with anger. "And all of it will drop neatly into Black Billy's clutching paws. Black Billy, who pukes his guts out every time he has a ship under him." While he was still brooding on the injustice of it, the auctioneer announced in a loud braying voice the next item for sale. "My lords, ladies and gentlemen, we are pleased and privileged to offer for your delectation a rare and wonderful trophy that will delight and intrigue even the most sophisticated and world-weary among you." With a flourish, he lifted the covering cloth from a large jar of thick, transparent glass, which stood on the table in front of him. "None other than the pickled head of the notorious and bloodthirsty brigand and corsair, Jangiri or Al-Auf, the bad one." A buzz and stir swept over the tiers of merchants, and they craned forward to peer ghoulishly at the disembodied head swimming in its bath of spirits. Tom felt a physical shock as he looked once again into Al-Auf's face. His dark hair floated like seaweed around his head. One of his eyes was open. It seemed to single out Tom and stare up at him with mild astonishment. There was a pained expression on his lips, as if he could still feel the stinging kiss of the blade that had parted head from trunk. "Come, gentlemen," the auctioneer wheedled, "this is an item of value. Many persons across the land would be pleased to pay their sixpence for a peek at it. Do I hear £5 bid?" Slowly a sense of outrage overcame Tom. He had taken the head as proof to the directors of John Company of the success of their expedition, not to become a bizarre sideshow in a travelling circus. His instincts and his training had instilled in him the concept of compassion and respect for a vanquished foe. That Al-Auf had captured and sold Dorian into slavery did not enter into it. Without thinking, he shouted angrily, £10! He did not have that sum at his disposal, but his share of the prize was owing to him. All around the hall, heads turned and faces peered at him curiously. He heard their whispers. "It's Hal Courtney's lad, the one who cropped the head. That's him. He lopped Al-Auf."
"What's his name?"
"Tom Courtney. He's Sir Hal's boy."
The auctioneer bowed theatrically to him.
"The bold swordsman and executioner himself has bid £10. Is there any advance on £10? Someone in the front row of benches began to clap, and it was taken up by those around him. Slowly the applause became a roar, until they were all clapping and stamping their feet. Tom wanted to shout to them to stop. He wanted to tell them that he had not killed the man for their approbation. But there was no words to describe what he had felt as he took Al-Auf's head, and what he felt now as he watched it floating in a bottle offered for the sport of gawking peasants.
"Going for the first time? Going for the second time, sold to Mr. Tom Courtney for the sum of £10.
"Pay them out of my share," Tom snapped at Walsh and jumped to his feet. He wanted to get out into the fresh air, away from the stares and the grins of this host of strangers. He shouldered his way out of the chamber and ran down the great staircase. When he strode out into Leadenhall Street, it was raining. He swung his cloak over his shoulders, crammed the wide-brimmed hat with its cavalier's feather onto his head, and adjusted his sword-belt before he stepped out from under the portico. There was a touch on his shoulder, and he swung round. In his preoccupation, he had not seen Uberly among the crowd of loafers at the entrance to the sale-rooms. "I have found our man, Klebby." Uberly led forward a tall, lean fellow, swathed in a sea-cloak, whose features were hidden by the Monmouth cap pulled low over his eyes. For a moment, Tom was not certain of Uberly's meaning.
"The man to take your father back to Plymouth by sea instead of over the roads," Uberly prompted him.
"Then let's take a pot of ale while we discuss it," Tom suggested, and they ran through the rain to the alehouse at the corner of Cornhill. In the stuffy front room, crowded with lawyers and clerks and redolent of the smoke of tobacco pipes, the yeasty odours of the beer kegs, they threw off their cloaks and hats, and Tom turned to study the face of the man Uberly had brought him.
"This is Captain Luke Jarvis," Uberly told him. "He sailed with your father and me in the old Pegasus."
Tom liked him immediately. He had a sharp, intelligent eye and the look of a tough seaman. His skin was tanned and creased by the sun and salt.
"Luke has a fast cutter, and he knows every inch of the channel, especially the French ports, like the back of his hand." Uberly smiled significantly. "He can give the slip to any excise man or froggy."
Tom did not catch his meaning immediately, but then Uberly went on.
"If it is a shipment of good limousine cognac you are looking for, then Luke is your man."
Tom grinned when he realized that Luke was a smuggler. If that was the case, he was the perfect choice for taking them on a quick voyage down the channel. His vessel would be quick as a ferret, and he would be able to navigate the dangerous waters on a moonless night in a gale. Tom shook his hand.
"Uberly has told you what we want. What would be the price of your hire, Captain?"
"I owe Sir Henry my life, and more," said Luke Jarvis, and touched the long white scar that ran down his left cheek. "I will not charge him a brass farthing. It would make me proud to be of service to him."
Tom did not ask about the scar, but thanked him. Then he said, "Uberly will bring you word when my father is ready to leave London." When Lord Courtney returned from his first visit to the House of Lords, Tom could see at a glance how the journey and the ceremony had taxed him. He carried him tenderly up the staircase to the bedroom in Bombay House, and Hal fell asleep almost immediately. Tom sat by his bed until evening, when a footman brought up a dinner tray.
"Where's William?"
Hal asked weakly, as Tom fed him spoonfuls of soup. "He's with Master Samuels at the bank. Lord Childs handed over the company note to him for the share of the prize, and he's gone to deposit it," Tom told him. He did not remark on how swiftly William's concern for his father's health had abated once his barony was established and its succession to William's person assured. William's main interest now is to see the gold safely lodged with the bankers in the Strand, where it would be under his control.
"You must rest now, Father. You must regain your strength for the journey home.
Our business here in London is almost done. The sooner we can get you back to High Wheel, the sooner you will be restored to full health."
"Yes, Tom,"
Hal showed sudden animation. "I want to go home now. Did you know that William and Alice have given me a grandson? They have named him Francis, after your grandfather."
"Yes, Father," Tom answered. "William told me." William had made the point quite clear that now he had fathered an heir, the inheritance of the title and estate had passed out of Tom's reach forever.
"I have engaged a vessel to take us back to Plymouth. The captain is Luke Jarvis. Do you remember him? He says you saved his life."
Hal smiled. "Luke? He was a likely lad, a good fellow. I'm happy to hear he has his own ship now. It's only a small cutter, but a fast one."
"I would like to sail at once, Tom."
Hal gripped his arm. There was an eagerness in his expression.
"We should wait for the doctors to give the word."
It was another week before the four surgeons agreed reluctantly to allow Hal to be taken aboard the Raven, Luke Jarvis's ship. They sailed from the company wharf in the late afternoon to
to make the most dangerous part of the voyage at night. William was not with them. Now that the prize money from the auction was safely deposited with Samuel's bank in the Strand, he had been anxious to get back to take care of the running of the estate.
Every hour that I am away costs us money. I mistrust those rogues and imbeciles I had to leave in charge during my absence. I will post down to Plymouth at once. I will meet your ship when you arrive, Father.
The Raven proved as swift as her reputation had promised. As they ran south in the night, Tom stood beside Luke Jarvis at the tiller. Luke wanted to hear every detail of their voyage to the Indies, and he questioned Tom avidly.
Oh, sweet Jesus, if only I'd known I would have signed on with Captain Al. Quick as you can say, Jack Flash.
What about your wife and babes?
Aberley grinned, showing white teeth in the darkness.
If I never hear another brat squeal or a good wife scold, it will not break my heart.
Luke pulled at his pipe, and the glow lit his rugged face.
Then he took the stem out of his mouth and pointed with it into the east. See those lights over there? That's Calais. I was in there 3 nights ago to take on a cargo of brandy and baccy. The roads are thick with shipping like fleas on a mangy dog.
He smiled wolfishly in the starlight.
If a man had a letter of marque, he wouldn't have to sail all the way to the Orient to find a prize.
Doesn't it trouble your conscience to trade with the French when we're at war with them? Tom asked, puzzled.
Oh, somebody has to do it, Luke said. Otherwise there'd be no brandy and baccy to comfort our fighting lads. I'm a patriot, I am.
He said it seriously, and Tom did not pursue it, but he mused on what Luke had said about the French shipping crowding the Channel ports. When the Raven tied up at the quay in Plymouth, William proved as good as his word. He had a big, well-sprung coach on the dock, and servants standing ready to carry Howell into it. They set out at a sedate pace on the road for High Weald, and all along the way they passed small groups of men and women, the labourers, miners, and tenant farmers of the estate, gathered to cheer his lordship home. Howell insisted on sitting up so that they could see him, and when he recognised a face among them, he made the driver halt so that he could shake the fellow's hand through the coach window. When they wheeled through the gates and crunched up the drive to the big house, all the servants were drawn up on the front steps. Some of the women wept to see Howell's state as the footman carried him in, and the men muttered gruff greetings.
"Jesus love you, my lord. It does our hearts good to have you safe at home."
Alice Courtney, William's wife, waited at the top of the stairs. She had the baby in her arms. A tiny creature, Tom saw, with a bright red wrinkled face. He squalled petulantly when Alice placed him for a moment in Howell's arms, but Howell smiled proudly and kissed the top of his head, which was covered with a thick black cap of hair.
"It looks like a monkey," Tom thought.
Then he looked more closely at Alice's face. Although there had never been the opportunity to get to know her when she married William, he had liked her instinctively. She had been pretty and gay, but now he hardly recognised her. There was an air of melancholy about her. Her eyes were sad, and though her skin was still peach-soft and unblemished, she seemed careworn. When Hal was carried inside the main doors, she lingered on the top step to greet Tom.
"Welcome home, brother." She kissed his cheek and dropped a curtsy.
"You have a beautiful baby." Tom touched the little face awkwardly and jerked away his fingers when the child squealed again.
"As beautiful as his mother," he finished lamely.
"Thank you, Tom," she said, and smiled. Then she dropped her voice so that none of the servants could hear her.
"I must talk to you. Not here, but at the first opportunity."
She turned away quickly and handed the baby to a nurse, while Tom followed his father up the stairs. As soon as he was free to do so, Tom went down the passage towards the back stairs, but he had to pass Dorian's room. He opened the door, stood on the threshold, and felt a nostalgic pang as he looked about the small chamber. It was as his little brother had left it. There were the companies of lead soldiers in pretty painted uniforms, arrayed along the window ledge, and the kite Tom had made for him, hanging above the bed. The memories were too painful. He closed the door quietly and went down the back stairs. He slipped through the kitchen and stable yards and ran lightly up the hill towards the chapel. It was dark and cool in the vault, just a thin beam of sunlight burning down from the opening in the centre of the domed roof. He saw with relief that the chest containing his grandfather's body stood against the far wall beside the stone sarcophagus that had been prepared so long ago to receive it. It had made the long voyage up from Bombay and the Cape of Good Hope safely. He went to the coffin, laid his hand on the lid, and whispered, "Welcome home, grandfather. You will be more comfortable here than in that cave in a far and savage land." Then he passed down the line of stone tombs until he reached the one in the centre. He stopped before it and read the inscription aloud. "Elizabeth Courtney, wife of Henry and mother of Dorian, taken by the sea before her full flowering, rest in peace." "Dorian is not here today, but he will be soon," he said aloud. "I swear it." He went on to the tomb of his own mother, stooped over it to kiss the cold marble lips of her effigy. Then he knelt before it. "I am safe home, mother, and Guy is well. He is in India now, working for John Company. He's married. You would like Caroline, his wife. She is a pretty girl with a lovely voice." He spoke to her as though she were alive and listening, and he stayed beside her sarcophagus until the sunbeam on the stone walls had made its full circuit and at last winked out, leaving the vault in semi-darkness. Then he groped his way up the stairs and out into the dusk. He stood and gazed down upon the darkling landscape he remembered so well, but which now seemed so alien to him. Beyond the rolling hills he saw the distant sea. It seemed to beckon to him from beyond the twinkle of lights that marked the harbour. He felt as though he had been away for a lifetime. But far from being content, he felt restless, consumed with the need to move on. Africa was out there, and that was where his heart longed to be. "I wonder," he whispered as he started down the hill, "if I will ever be happy in one place again." As he reached the bottom of the hill, the pile of the house was only a dark shadow looming in the evening mists that drifted across the lawns. Tom stopped abruptly below the ha-ha wall as he glimpsed a ghostly figure beneath the outspread branches of one of the old oak trees that stood dark and massive upon the lawns. It was a female figure dressed all in white, and Tom felt a stir of superstitious awe, for it appeared ethereal and wraith-like. There were many legends of the ghosts that haunted Highweald. When he and Guy were boys, their nurse had frightened them with those tales. "I'll not be bettered by any ghost," Tom resolved, gathered his courage and strode towards the white girl. She seemed oblivious of his approach until he was almost upon her. Then she looked up, her face frightened, and he saw it was his sister-in-law, Alice. The moment she recognised him, she gathered up her skirts and fled towards the house. "Alice!" he called and ran after her. She did not look back, but increased her pace. He caught up with her on the gravel drive below the façade of the house and grabbed her wrist. "Alice, it's me, Tom," he said. "Don't be alarmed." "Let me go," she said in a terrified tone, and looked up at the windows of the house, which were already glowing cheerfully with yellow candlelight. "You wanted to speak to me," he reminded her. "What is it you want to tell me?" "Not here, Tom. He will see us together." "Billy?" Tom was puzzled. "What can he do?" "You don't understand. You must let me go." "I am not afraid of Black Billy," he told her, with youthful arrogance. "Then you should be," she said, pulled her hand free, and ran lightly up the steps into the house. Standing in the middle of the carriageway with both hands on his hips, Tom watched her go. He was about to turn away when something made him look up. His elder brother stood at one of the tall bedroom windows on the second floor. The light was behind him, so he was merely a slim, elegant silhouette. Neither of them moved for a long moment. Then Tom made an impatient, dismissive gesture and followed Alice into the house. Tom was in his bedchamber when he heard a faint sound that was out of place, even in the old house with its creaking timbers and windswept roof. He stood still, with his stock half-tied, and cocked his head to listen. After a few seconds, the sound came again, like a rabbit in a snare.
the wail of distress high and plaintive. He went to the window and opened the latch. When he threw wide the shutters, the night breeze off the sea rushed in, and the cries were stronger. He recognized them as human. It was a woman's weeping, punctuated by deeper male tones. Tom leaned out of the window. Now he could hear that the sounds came from the floor below, where the main bedchambers were situated. Abruptly, the voices fell silent, and he was about to close his window again when he heard the sound of a blow. It must have been a heavy one to carry so clearly. And Tom's heart tripped as the woman cried out again. This time it was a scream of pain, so high and clear that he could not mistake who had uttered it. "A swine," he blurted out, and whirled to the door. In his shirt sleeves, his stock loosening, its ends dangling down his chest, he raced along the passage to the staircase and bounded down three steps at a time. As he reached the door to his father's apartment, he hesitated. The double doors stood wide open, and the curtains of the four-poster bed across the room were drawn aside so he could see Hal's figure lying under the embroidered bedclothes. He was propped up on the pillows, and he called urgently to Tom as he passed the open doors. "No, Tom, come here." Tom ignored his summons and ran on to the doors of William's apartment further down the passage. He tried the handle, but it was locked, so he hammered on it with his clenched fists. "Open up, damn you, Billy," he bellowed. There was a long silence beyond, and he filled his lungs to shout again, when the door opened quietly and William stood in the opening, blocking it with his body so that Tom could not see past him. "What is it you want?" William asked. "How dare you come yelling at the door to my private rooms?" He was also in his shirt sleeves, but his face was darkly flushed with anger or exertion, and his eyes burned with fury. "Get away with you, you impertinent puppy." "I want to speak to Alice." Tom stood his ground stubbornly. "You have already spoken to her once this evening. Alice is busy. You cannot see her now. I heard someone cry out. It was not here. Perhaps you heard a gull or the wind in the eaves." "There is blood on your shirt." Tom pointed at the tiny scarlet specks on his brother's white sleeve. William looked down and smiled coldly through his anger. Then he brought out his right hand from behind his back and sucked the cut on his swollen knuckle. "I caught my hand at the cupboard doors. I must see Alice." Tom made to push past him. But at that, Alice's voice called urgently, "Tom, please go away. I cannot see you now." Her voice was gusty with tears and pain. "Please, Tom, listen to my husband. You cannot come in here." "Now do you believe me?" William asked scornfully. "Alice will not talk to you." He stepped back and closed the door. Tom stood indecisively in front of it. He lifted his hand to knock again, but his father's voice stopped him. Hal was calling him. "Tom, come here. I want you." Tom turned away from the door and went to stand beside the four-poster bed. "Father, I heard..." "You heard nothing, Tom. Nothing." "But I did." Tom's voice was tight with outrage. "Close the doors, Tom. There is something I must say to you." Tom did as he was told, then came back to the bed. "There is one thing you must remember for the rest of your life, Tom. You must never interfere between a husband and wife. Alice is William's chattel. He can do with her as he wishes. If you try to step between them, he is within his rights to kill you. You heard nothing, Tom." When he went down to supper, Tom was still seething with anger. Three places were set at the long polished table, and William was already seated at its head. "You are late, Thomas," he said, and he was smiling, relaxed and handsome, with a heavy gold chain around his neck and a bright ruby brooch hanging on his chest. "We sit down to supper at 8 o'clock at Highweald. Please try to abide by the custom of the house while you are a guest here." "Highweald is my home," Tom protested coldly. "I am not a guest." "That is a matter for debate, but I hold the contrary view. Where is Alice?" Tom looked pointedly at the empty place on William's left-hand side. "My wife is indisposed," William answered smoothly. "She will not be joining us this evening. Please, take your seat. It is passing strange, but I find myself without appetite. There is something hereabouts that has put me off my food. I will not be dining with you this evening, Brother William. As you wish, William shrugged, and turned his attention to the stemmed glass the butler was filling with red wine. In his present mood, Tom could not trust himself to spend the night in the same house as his brother. He threw on a cloak and stormed down to the stables. He shouted for the grooms, who came tumbling down the ladder from their quarters in the loft above, and saddled one of the horses for him. Tom galloped the first mile, standing in the stirrups and driving his mount on through the night. The night air cooled his rage a little, so he took pity on the horse and reined him in to a trot along the Plymouth Road. He found Aberley with Luke Jarvis in the taproom of the Royal Oak, near the harbour. They welcomed him with unfeigned pleasure, and Tom drank the first pot of ale without taking it from his lips or drawing breath. At one stage of the evening he climbed the back stairs to a small room overlooking the harbour, with a pretty laughing lass who helped him when he lost his balance and steadied him when he almost fell back down the stairs. Her naked body was very white in the lamplight, and her embrace was warm and engulfing. She laughed in his ear as she clung to him, and he spent his anger on top of her. Later she giggled and waved away the coin he offered her. "I shall be the one who pays you, Master Tom!" Nearly everyone in the town had known Tom since childhood. "What a darling boy you've grown into! It's been many a month since my porridge pot was so well stirred!" Much later, Aberley prevented him from accepting a challenge to arms from another over-refreshed seaman, and dragged him out of the tavern, helped him up onto his horse, and led him, swaying in the saddle, singing lustily, to High Weald. Early the next morning, Tom rode up onto the moors with one of his saddlebags bulging. Aberley was waiting for him at the crossroads, a dark exotic figure in the thick mist. He wheeled his horse in beside Tom's. "I think the good burghers of Plymouth would have preferred an attack by the French rather than your last visit." He looked sideways at Tom. "Do you not suffer still from last night's alarms and excursions, Klebe?" "I slept like the innocent child I am, Aberley. Why should I suffer?" Tom tried to smile, but his eyes were bloodshot. "The joy and folly of youth." Aberley shook his head in mock wonder. Tom grinned, put the spurs to his mount, and sent him soaring over the hedge. Aberley followed him, and they galloped over the brow of the hill to where a grove of dark trees nestled in the fold of ground beyond. Tom pulled up, jumped down, tied his horse to one of the branches, then strode into the field of ancient stones that stood in the grove. They were mossy with age, and legend said that they marked the graves of the old people who had been buried here back in the infancy of time. He chose a propitious spot among them, allowing his feet, not his head, to guide him. At last he stamped his heel into the damp turf. "Here," he said, and Aberley stepped forward with the spade in his hand. He drove the blade deep into the soft earth and began to dig. When he paused for breath, Tom took his turn and stopped when the hole was waist deep. He climbed out of it and went back to where he had tethered his horse. He unbuckled the flap of his saddlebag and carefully lifted out a cloth-wrapped burden. He carried it back and set it down on the lip of the hole they had dug. He unwrapped the cloth from the jar. Through the glass, Al-Auf glared back at him with one sardonic eye. "Will you say a prayer for the dead, Aberley? Your Arabic is better than mine." Aberley recited it in a deep, strong voice that echoed weirdly in the dark grove. When he fell silent, Tom rewrapped the jar, hiding its grisly contents, and laid it in the bottom of the grave they had prepared for it. "You are a brave man, Al-Auf. May your God, Allah, pardon your sins, for they were many and grievous." He closed the grave and stamped down the loose soil. Then he packed the green sods over it to hide the disturbed earth. They went to the horses and mounted. From the saddle, Aberley looked back into the grove for the last time. "You killed your man in single combat," he said softly, "and you have treated his corpse with honour. You have become a warrior indeed, Klebe." They turned the horses' heads and rode together down the moor towards the sea. It was as though Hal Courtney had realized that the hourglass of his life was dribbling out the last grains of sand. His thoughts dwelt much on death and its trappings. From his bed he sent for the master stonemason from the town, and showed him the design he had drawn for his tomb.
"I know full well what you want of me, my lord."
The mason was grey and grizzled, with the stone dust etched into his paws.
"Of course you do, John," Hal said.
The man was an artist with chisel and mallet. He had carved the sarcophagus for Hal's father, and for all his wives. It was fitting that he should do the same for the master of High Weald. Then Hal ordered the funeral of his father to be conducted by the bishop. His body would be laid to rest at last in the sarcophagus that John the Master Mason had prepared for it almost 2 decades before. The chapel was filled with the family and all those who had known Sir Francis Courtney. The servants and labourers from the estate, dressed in their best clothes, filled the back pews and overflowed into the churchyard. Hal sat in the centre of the aisle, in a special chair that the estate carpenters had adapted for him, with high sides to steady him, and handles at each corner so that he could be carried about by 4 sturdy footmen. The rest of the Courtney family sat in the front pew. There were 12 cousins, uncles and aunts, as well as the closer relatives. William was in the seat nearest his father, and Alice sat beside him. This was the first time she had appeared in public since the night Tom had tried to force his way into their private apartments. She was dressed in mourning black, with a dark veil covering her face. But when she raised the corner of it to dab at her eyes, Tom leaned forward and saw that the side of her face was swollen, a deep cut in her lip was covered with a black scab, and an ugly old bruise on her cheek had faded purple and green. She sensed Tom's eyes on her, and hurriedly dropped the veil. In the pew on the other side of the aisle sat the guests of honour, 4 knights of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail. Nicholas Childs and Oswald Hyde had come down from London together. Alice's father, John Grenville, Earl of Exeter, had ridden across from his own vast estates which bordered High Weald, with his younger brother, Arthur. After the ceremony, the party returned to the big house for the funeral banquet. The family and the guests of honour ate in the great dining room, while trestle tables, groaning with food and drink, were set up in the stable yard for the peasantry. Hal's hospitality was so bountiful, the offerings from the cellars of High Weald so copious, that before the afternoon was out, 2 peers of the realm were forced to retire to their rooms to rest. The bishop was so overcome by the exigencies of his office and the fine claret that he had to be assisted up the main staircase by 2 footmen, pausing on the landing to dispense blessings on the mourners gathered below to watch his progress. The revellers in the stable yard, after freely availing themselves of the pots of foaming cider, took advantage of the hedgerows and haystacks for similar purposes, and others less sedate. Mingled with the snores of the imbibers were the lusty rustle of hay, the giggles and happy cries of young couples otherwise occupied. At dusk the 4 knights of the order came down from their rooms in various stages of recovery from the morning banquet, and climbed into the waiting carriages. The small cavalcade left the house and followed Hal and Tom in the leading carriage back up the hill to the chapel. In the vault, the ceremonials of the order had been set out in the crypt. The mosaic design on the floor was in the shape of the 5-pointed star, and in the centre were 3 bronze cauldrons containing the ancient elements of fire, earth and water. The flames from the brazier danced on the stone walls and cast weird shadow shapes in the corners beyond the lines of stone tombs. Hal's chair stood ready to receive him at the door of the chapel. Once he was seated in it, his brother knights carried him down the steps into the vault and set down the chair in the centre of the pentacle, with the 3 cauldrons surrounding him. Tom, wearing the simple white robes of an acolyte, waited alone in the nave of the chapel above, praying before the altar in the light of the torches in their brackets set high on the walls. He could hear the voices of the knights murmuring and echoing softly from the vault below as they opened the lodge in the first degree. Then there was a heavy footstep on the stone stairs as the Earl of Exeter, Tom's sponsor, came up to summon him. Tom followed him down the stairs to where the other knights were waiting for him within the sacred circle. Their swords were drawn, and they wore the gold rings and chains of their offices as Nortonia knights, the navigators of the first degree of the order. Tom knelt at the border of the pentacle and begged for entrance. "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, who would enter the lodge of the temple of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail?" his father challenged him in a gusty voice, like a man saved from drowning. "A novice who presents himself for initiation to the mysteries of the temple." "Enter on peril of your eternal life," his father invited him. And Hal's gentle tone made the warning more poignant. Tom rose to his feet and stepped over the mosaic marble pattern that marked the boundaries of the mystic circle. He had not expected to feel anything, but suddenly he shivered, as though an enemy had marked his grave with the thrust of a sword into the earth. "Who sponsors this novice?" Hal asked in the same reedy voice. The Earl spoke up boldly. "I do." Hal looked back at his son, and his mind wandered away to the hilltop in the savage, untamed land far below the equator where he had made his own vows so long ago. He looked out of the circle to the stone sarcophagus which at last held his own father's body. He smiled almost dreamily as he considered the continuity, the enchanted chain of the knighthood that linked one generation to the next. He felt his own mortality creeping towards him like a man-eating beast stalking him from the darkness. "It will be easier to meet the Dark One when I have placed the future firmly in the hands of my sons," he thought. And it seemed then that he could see that figure merging from the past and evolving before his eyes. He saw shadowy figures he recognized, the enemies he had fought, the men and women he had loved, and who were long dead, mingling with others whom he knew had not yet passed into the mist of days to come. The Earl reached out gently and placed a hand on Hal's bowed shoulder to call him back to the present. Hal roused himself and looked at Tom again. "Who are you?" he began the long catechism. "Thomas Courtney, son of Henry and of Margaret." Hal felt the tears rise in his eyes at the mention of the woman he had loved so dearly. The melancholy was deep in his soul. He felt an exhaustion of the spirit, and he wanted to rest, but he knew he could not until he had completed the tasks appointed to him. He roused himself once more and offered Tom the blade of the blue Neptune sword, which he had inherited from his own father. The light of the torches danced on the gold inlay of the blade and glowed in the depths of the sapphire on the pommel. "I call on you to confirm the tenets of your faith upon this blade." Tom touched the blade and began the recital. "These things I believe, that there is but one God in Trinity, the Father eternal, the Son eternal, and the Holy Ghost eternal."
"Amen," said the Nortonia knights together.
The question and answer continued while the torches guttered. Each question adumbrated the code of the order, taken almost entirely from that of the Knights Templar. The catechism outlined the history of the Templars. It recalled how in the year 1312 the poor knights of Christ and the Temple of Solomon had been attacked and destroyed by the King of France, Philippe le Bel, in connivance with his puppet, Pope Clement V of Bordeaux. The Templars' vast fortune in bullion and land was confiscated by the crown, and their master was tortured and burned at the stake. However, warned by their allies, the Templar mariners slipped their moorings in the French Channel harbours and stood out to sea. They steered for England and sought the protection of King Edward. Since then, they had opened their lodges in Scotland and England under new names, but with the basic tenets of the order intact. At last, the questions had been asked and answered. Tom knelt, and the knights formed a circle around him. They laid one of their hands on his bowed head, the other on the hilt of the Neptune sword. "Thomas Courtney, we welcome you into the Grail Company, and we accept you as a brother knight of the Temple of the Order of St. George and the Holy Grail." They lifted him to his feet, and one after the other embraced him. This was all part of the ancient ritual, but as Tom stooped to kiss his father, Hal departed from the time-honoured form. He placed the hilt of the Neptune sword in Tom's hand and closed his fingers over it.
"It is yours now, my son. Wield it with courage
and honour. Tom knew that the beautiful blade was one of his father's most prized possessions. He could find no words then to express his gratitude, but he stared deep into Hal's eyes. He saw that his father indeed understood the silent message of love and duty he was trying to send him. After the funeral guests and the four knights of the order had left, Highweald seemed silent and deserted. Alice spent most of her days in her private apartment. Tom saw her once, riding alone on the moors, and though he watched her from a distance, he remembered the consequences of their last brief encounter and did not approach her. William was engrossed in the management of the estate, and passed his days at the office of the tin mine, conferring with his steward or riding around the estate making unannounced appearances, with the object of catching malingerers and wrongdoers among his servants. Misdemeanours were punished with the whip and instant expulsion from the estate. He returned to the house in the evenings to spend an hour with his father before the punctual 8 o'clock supper. He ate alone, for Alice did not join him, and Tom found excuse to eat in his room or at one of the local taverns, where with Aberley and Luke Jarvis, Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson, he could find more convivial company. As the months passed, Tom grew increasingly restless and impatient. While William was out of the house, he spent the greater part of each day with his father. He carried Hal down to the library and sat him on his chair at the head of the long oak table, then brought down from the crowded shelves the books and maps for which Hal asked. They spread them on the table and pored over them earnestly, discussing the details of the voyage that Tom knew his father would never make. Master Walsh, with a pair of newly purchased spectacles perched on his nose, sat at the far end of the table and took down the notes Hal dictated to him. They drew up detailed inventories of the stores and equipment they would need, and watch bills for the men who would crew the ships of the expedition back to the Indian Ocean.
Two ships, Hal decided. Not as large as the Seraph or the Minotaur. Fast, handy vessels, but well armed, for we will certainly have to fight the Pagan again. Not too deep a draught, as we will probably have to take them up the estuaries and rivers of the Fever Coast.
I will send Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson to look for ships that will suit us, Tom cut in eagerly. They can ride along the coast and call in at every harbour between Plymouth and Margate. But with war raging on the continent, the right ships will not be easy to find.
If you have gold to pay for them, you will be amazed at how easy they will be to find, Hal demurred. If I have to spend every farthing of the prize we took from Al Auf to win back Dorian from the Arabs, it will be money well spent.
We could put a notice in a broadsheet, suggested Master Walsh.
A good suggestion, Hal said.
We could also ask Lord Childs for a company ship, Tom looked up from the chart.
No, Hal shook his head. If Childs knows we are taking a squadron back into the domain of John Company, he will do his best to prevent us. The company is strongly opposed to what they call interlopers trading, or even sailing into their territory.
Day after day they continued with the planning and discussions. Then, 15 days after Tom had dispatched them along the coast, Ned Tyler and Alf Wilson returned with news that they had found a ship. It was ideal for the task, but the owners were asking the criminally exorbitant sum of £7,000 for her. They had with them a letter of acceptance for Hal to sign, and a request from the owners that they be paid by a banker's draft.
Hal questioned the pair keenly on the condition and standing of the ship, then closed his eyes and sat in silence for so long that Tom became alarmed.
Father!
He jumped up from his chair and went to Hal's side. He touched his cheek and found that it was burning with fever.
His lordship is not well. Give me a hand, lads. We must take him up to his bed.
Even Master Walsh grabbed a handle of the chair, and between them they rushed Hal up the stairs. Once he was safely laid in the big bed, Tom sent Aberley down to Plymouth to summon Dr. Reynolds from his lodgings in the town. Then he dismissed Ned Tyler and the others and sent them to wait below. When they were gone, he locked the doors to the bedchamber to be alone with his father. He turned back the bedclothes and, with trepidation, began to unwrap the bandages from the stumps of his legs. By this time, Hal was flushed with the sudden fever in his blood and muttered incoherently in delirium. When Tom lifted off the last cloth, he saw that the scar had burst open again, and that the discharge was pouring yellow from the open wound. The familiar cloying odour filled the chamber, and Tom knew that once again the deep corruption had flared up, but this time more virulently than ever before. The entire stump was riven with scarlet lines, as though it had been lashed with a whip. Dr. Reynolds had warned him of this symptom, and now he groped with trembling fingers in his father's groin, afraid of what he might find. The glands were swollen hard and lumpy as walnut shells, and Hal moaned in agony when Tom touched them. "It is the gas gangrene," Dr. Reynolds confirmed when he arrived. "This time I cannot save him."
"Can you not cut it away?" Tom shouted at him. "Can you not drain the corruption like you did before?"
"It has gone too high." Reynolds traced with his fingertips the furious red lines that were appearing over Hal's lower belly even as they stared at it.
"You must be able to do something," Tom pleaded.
"It burns through all his body like a fire in dry grass. Your father will be dead by morning," Reynolds told him simply. "You should send for your elder brother to pay his last respects." Tom sent Aberley to find William, but he was down the main shaft of the tin mine at East Rushwood. Aberley waited until evening when Hal's eldest son returned to the surface. When he heard of his father's sudden turn for the worse, William galloped back to the house. He burst into Hal's bedchamber with such a show of concern that Tom thought it might readily be mistaken for eagerness. "How is he?" William demanded from Dr. Reynolds.
"It grieves me to tell you, but his lordship is sinking fast."
William ignored Tom and went to kneel at the far side of the bed.
"Father, it's William. Can you hear me?"
Hal stirred at the sound of his voice, but did not open his eyes.
"Speak to me,"
William insisted, but Hal's breathing was shallow and light.
"He is going," William said.
Tom looked up at him sharply. He thought he had detected a note of satisfaction in his tone. "Not long to wait now, Billy," he agreed, his tone expressionless. "By morning you should be Lord Courtney."
"You are a despicable little toad," William snarled. "I will make you pay for that jibe in heavy coin."
Neither spoke again for an hour. Then suddenly William rose from his knees.
"It is 8 o'clock and I am famished. I have not eaten all day. Will you come down to supper?"
"I will stay here." Tom did not look at him. "He may wake and need us."
"Reynolds will call us. It will take only a minute to come up from the dining room."
"You go, Billy. I will call you," Tom promised. And William went stiffly to the door. He was back within half an hour, wiping his lips with the napkin he carried. "How is he now?" he asked, with a touch of diffidence in his voice.
"He has not missed you," Tom answered. "Do not worry, Billy. He cannot disinherit you for taking a good supper."
They settled down for the long vigil, one on each side of the bed, and Reynolds stretched out fully dressed on the bed in the dressing room, snoring softly. The big house seemed to be holding its breath. And outside, the night was so still and quiet that Tom could hear the clock in the steeple of the chapel on the hill chiming the passage of the hours. When it struck 1 in the morning, he looked across at William on the opposite side of the four-poster. His head had slumped forward onto the bed cover, and he was breathing heavily. Tom laid a hand on his father's brow. "It's a little cooler," he thought. "Perhaps the fever is receding again, as it has so often before." For the first time that night, he felt a small lift of hope. His father stirred at his touch and opened his eyes.
"Are you there, Tom?"
"Here I am, Father," Tom replied, trying to make his tone joyous. "You are going to be well. We will sail together again as we planned."
"I will not be coming with you, lad."
Hal had admitted at last what Tom had known all along.
"This is a voyage you will have to make on your own."
"I wish," Tom began, but his father groped for his hand.
"Don't waste time denying it," he whispered. "There is little time left. Give me your word you will find Dorian for me. I give you my word, as I gave my solemn oath to Dorry.
Hal sighed and closed his eyes again. With a flare of alarm, Tom thought the worst, but then he opened them again.
William. Where is William?
The sound of his own name roused William, who lifted his head.
I am here, Father. Give me your right hand, William, Hal demanded. And you, Tom, give me yours.
They gave them to him, and he went on.
William, you know what terrible fate has befallen your youngest brother.
Yes, Father.
I have charged Tom with the duty of finding him and rescuing him. Tom has accepted that duty. Now I charge you also. Are you listening, William?
Yes, Father.
I lay on you the solemn duty that you will do all in your power to help Tom with his quest to rescue Dorian. You will provide him with the ships he needs. You will pay for the crews, the stores, and all else. You will not stint him, but you will make good the manifest that Tom and I have drawn up together.
William nodded.
I understand what it is you wish, Father.
Then swear it to me, Hal insisted, his voice rising. There is little time left.
I swear it, William said quietly and sincerely.
Thank God for that, Hal murmured. He lay for a while, as if gathering his strength for one last effort. But he clung to their hands with surprising strength. Then he spoke again.
You are brothers. Brothers should never be enemies. I want you to forget the old disputes that have torn you apart, and for my sake, become brothers in the full sense.
William and Tom were silent, neither looking at Hal nor at each other.
It is my dying wish. Please grant it to me, Hal begged.
Tom spoke first. I am ready to forget what is past. In the future I will give William the respect and affection he deserves.
I can ask for no more, Hal gasped. Now it is your turn, William. Swear it to me.
If Tom keeps to that promise, I will return the same respect and affection, William said, without looking across at Tom.
Thank you. Thank you both, Hal whispered. Now stay with me this little time that we have left together.
The night was long. More than once Tom thought Hal was dead, but when he listened at his father's lips he heard the soft sigh and hiss of his breathing. Then he must have dozed, for the next he heard was the crowing of the cocks in the stable yard. He started guiltily and looked across at William, and saw that he was slumped half across the bed, snoring softly. The lamp had burned out, but the first pale glimmer of dawn showed beyond the curtains. Tom touched his father's face, and with a terrible stab of grief felt that the skin was cold. He moved his fingers to search his throat for the pulse of the carotid. There was nothing, no flicker of life.
I should have stayed awake. I failed him at the last.
Tom leaned over and kissed his father's lips. Tears coursed down his cheeks and dripped onto Hal's face. He used a corner of the sheet to wipe them away and kissed him again. He waited for almost half an hour until the light in the bedchamber was stronger. Then he examined his own face in the mirror on the far wall to make certain that he had full control of his grief. He did not want Black Billy to see him so unmanned. He reached across and shook his elder brother.
Wake up, Billy. Father is gone.
William lifted his head and stared at him, dazed. In the dim light of dawn, his eyes were blurry and unfocused. Then he looked down at Hal's pale face.
So, it's over at last, he said.
He stood up stiffly and stretched.
Sweet Jesus, but the old rogue took his time. I thought he would never move over for me.
Father is dead, Tom thought he had not understood. Not even Black Billy could be so callous.
We'd best call Reynolds to make certain of that, and then seal him up in his fancy new tomb before he changes his mind.
William smiled at his own grim humour, then bellowed for the surgeon,
who came stumbling through from the dressing room, still half asleep. Swiftly he examined Hal, listened at his mouth for breathing, then ran his hand inside his nightshirt to feel for his heart. At last he shook his head and looked up at William.
"Your father is indeed gone, my lord."
Tom was stunned by how swift and simple it was. Billy was now Baron Dartmouth.
"Do you wish me to order the laying out and other preparations for interment, my lord?"
"Of course," William said. "I will be engaged. There is much that I have to see to. I will have to go up to London as soon as possible." He was talking to himself now rather than to the others. "I must take my seat in the House of Lords, then meet Master Samuels at the bank." He broke off and looked at Tom. "I want you to make the arrangements for the funeral. It's time you started to earn your keep." "I would be honoured." Tom tried to shame him, but William went on without check. "A quiet funeral, just the immediate family. We will get it over with as soon as possible. The bishop can do the honours if we can keep him sober long enough. A week from today," he decided abruptly. "I leave the details to you." He stretched again. "Oh, by God, but I'm hungry. I'll be at breakfast if you need me." There was no time for all of Hal's brother knights to assemble for his funeral. The Earl of Exeter and his brother were the only ones close enough to attend. However, the officers and men who had sailed with Hal struggled in from every corner of the county and every seaport along the coast. Some walked 50 miles to be there. Ned Tyler, Alf Wilson and Luke Jarvis found pews near the front of the chapel, and the common sailors and labourers from the estate crowded the nave and overflowed outside. "I will not spend my hard-earned guineas on food and drink for every loafer and tippler in the land," William decided, and paid only for the hospitality offered to his invited guests. From his own prize money, Tom purchased funeral meat and drink for the men who had come to honour his father. 2 days after Hal's body had been sealed in the new stone tomb in the vault of the family chapel, William took the coach up to London and was gone for almost 3 weeks. Before he left, he sent Alice and the baby to her father. Tom was certain that this was to prevent him speaking to her. He found the empty house so oppressive that he took rooms at the Royal Oak and spent his days there with Ned Tyler, Alf Wilson and Master Welsh planning the final details of the expedition to find Dorian. Working from the watchbills and manifests that he and Hal had drawn up, he prepared a budget to present to William on his return to High Weald. Time was running against Tom, for autumn was once again coming on apace. He had little more than 3 months to equip and man the ships, cross the Bay of Biscay, and reach the more clement southern waters before the gales of winter blocked his passage. "It will cost us another year of waiting if winter catches us," Tom fretted. He spoke for the stores they needed from the Chandlers and pledged his word against the return of William. The credit of the new Lord Courtney was good as any banker's. He hired a large warehouse at the docks to store the goods, then sent Ned and Aberley to call up the men they needed. After the triumph of their last expedition, there was little trouble in finding the best crew, all of whom had sailed on the Seraph. Most had already spent their prize money and were eager to take a berth with Tom. Ned Tyler and Alf found the second ship they needed and haggled the best price for her. However, the owners refused to hand over either ship until they had been paid in full. Tom had to curb his impatience. At the end of September, William returned from London to High Weald. He came in triumph. He had taken his seat in the House of Lords and had been presented at court. He had been the guest of Lord Childs at Bombay House for his entire stay in the city. Childs had sponsored his entry to fashionable London society, had introduced him to the halls of power, and had prevailed upon him to take a seat on the board of governors of John Company. Using the prize money he had inherited, William had increased his investment in the company to 7% of the issued share capital, to make himself one of the 5 major shareholders after the crown. The gossip in the town was that Alice had come back with him from her father's house, and it was said, too, that she was expecting another infant. As soon as he heard of William's return, Tom rode up from the town to High Weald, excited and eager to discuss his plans for the expedition with his brother. He carried 2 metal dispatch cases in his saddlebags. In them were all the papers he had assembled over the past weeks of waiting, the deeds of purchase of the two ships, the bills from the chandlers and suppliers of ship stores and trade goods. He arrived at the big house in the middle of the morning to find that William was already closeted in the library, in consultation with his bailiff. Tom was astonished to find a throng waiting their turn to see Lord Courtney. They crowded the entrance lobby, and at a rough count, Tom made it 16 in all. Most of them he knew. There was the family lawyer, John Anstey, the high sheriff of the county, overseers and engineers from the mine, and the mayor and senior alderman from the town. The others Tom did not recognise, but he greeted them all politely and chatted with Anstey while he waited for his brother to see him. When noon struck, he decided that William did not know he was waiting with the others, so he sent a note through with Evan, the steward, who returned almost immediately, looking uncomfortable. "His lordship says he will call you when he is ready to see you. In the meantime, you are to wait." The afternoon passed slowly. At intervals, Evan came to summon the others through to the library. By the evening, Tom was the last one left. "His lordship will see you now, Master Thomas," Evan said apologetically. Carrying a dispatch box under each arm and trying to conceal his irritation at the way in which he'd been treated, Tom went through to the library. He found William standing at the fireplace, his hands clasped behind his back, lifting the tail of his coat to present his backside to the warmth of the flames.
"Good afternoon, William. I hope that you have had a successful visit to London. I heard of your presentation at court. I offer you my congratulations."
He placed the dispatch boxes on the library table.
"How kind of you, brother."
William's tone was distant. At that moment, Evan returned with two goblets on a silver tray and offered one first to William. Then he came to Tom, and as Tom took the other goblet, Evan asked him, "Will you be staying to supper this evening, sir?" Before Tom could reply, William cut in.
"I think not, Evan. Master Thomas will not be staying long. I am sure he has plans to dine with his rough friends in the town."
Both Tom and Evan stared at him in astonishment. But he went on smoothly.
"That will be all, thank you, Evan. Supper at 8 o'clock as usual. I do not want to be disturbed before then."
He sipped the cognac and raised an eyebrow as he glanced at the black-painted tin dispatch boxes. "I am sure that you did not come merely to congratulate me. I have come for your approval of the manifest for the expedition, also the bills for the expenses I have already incurred."
"What expedition?"
William pretended puzzlement. "I do not remember asking you to run up any bills on my behalf. Perhaps I misheard you." "Your undertaking to our father." Tom tried not to show that he was put out by the denial. "I have almost completed the preparations." He opened the boxes and laid out the documents in neat piles down the length of the table. "These are the watch bills. I have found 150 good seamen. That's all the crew I will need. Every man jack of them sailed with our father, and I know them well. I can answer for every one." William stayed at the fireplace. There was a small, enigmatic smile on his lips, but his eyes were cold. "These are the bills of sale for the two ships. I have inspected both. They are ideal for our purposes, and I've managed to beat down the owner's asking price by almost £4,000. He looked up at William, but his brother remained silent. Tom waited a while for him to speak, and when he did not, he went on doggedly. "This is a complete manifest of the stores and equipment we will need. I have already purchased most of it, and I have it stored in Patchley's warehouse at the docks. I'm afraid I was forced to pay high prices. The Admiralty is buying up all available stores to equip the Navy. Powder and shot, rope and sails are in desperately short supply. Prices have more than doubled since the beginning of the war." He waited for William to reply, then said lamely, "I have given my word on the payment. I will need the money for these bills, and notes for the owners of the ships at once. The rest can wait a while." William sighed, crossed to one of the leather chairs, and threw himself into it. Tom started to speak again, but William cut him off by bellowing for one of the parlourmaids.
"Susan!"
She must have been waiting outside the door, anticipating his call, for she came at once. Tom knew her. She had been a child when he sailed with his father, but in his absence she had grown into a pretty girl, with dark ringlets peeping out from under her cap and sparkling blue eyes with naughty lights in them. She dropped Tom a quick curtsy,
then ran to answer William's call. William lifted one of his legs. She took it between her own legs with her bottom pointed towards him and seized his boot at toe and heel. She used the grip of her knees to prise it off his foot. When the boot slid off, William wriggled his stockinged toes and gave her the other foot. She repeated the process, but as the boot came free, William thrust his foot up under her petticoats. She squealed playfully and blushed scarlet.
"My lord!"
she cried. But instead of pulling away, she bent a little further over to let him explore with his toes as he wished. After a minute, William laughed. "Go on with you, you saucy little baggage." He pulled his foot out from under her skirts, placed it firmly on her rump, and gave her a playful shove towards the door. She scampered away, looking back archly over her shoulder as she closed the door. When you are done with exercising your rights as master of High Weald, may we return to the business of the expedition? Tom asked. Please go on, Thomas, William invited with a wave of his hand. Will you consider the list of costs? Damn me, Thomas, don't tire me with your lists. Come straight out and tell me how much you are begging for. I am begging only for that my father promised to me. Tom was having difficulty controlling his temper. The two ships are the main expense. Speak out, William snapped. Chase the fox into the open. How much is it? In all, it amounts to a little over £19,000, Tom said. But that includes trade goods. I will trade along the coast for ivory, gold, copper, and gum arabic. I expect to turn a handsome profit. He broke off as William began to laugh. It started as a chuckle, then escalated to a full-belly laugh. Tom stood and watched him, wrestling with his temper. William was choking on his mirth, and had to gasp for breath before he could go on. At last Tom could conceal his irritation no longer. "Perhaps I am slow, but I am not certain what it is that amuses you so, brother."
"Yes, Thomas, you are slow. It has not yet penetrated to the depths of your thick skull that I am now the master of High Weald and that you are beholden to me for every penny, not to our father's shadow."
"What I need is not for myself. It is for Dorian. It is for the oath that you swore to our father," Tom said grimly. "You gave him your word. You are oath-bound."
"I think not, Thomas." William stopped laughing abruptly. "At the end, father was in delirium. He was wandering in his mind. If I said anything, it was merely to placate him. I had no serious intent. It would be folly to squander my inheritance on the whim of a dying man. £19,000? You must have lost your senses if you think for one minute that I will hand that sum of money over to you so that you can go chasing off to the end of the world. Oh, no, 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 dear brother. Put it out of your head."
Tom stared at him speechlessly. "You are going back on your solemn word? Billy, I am not chasing off for my own pleasure. We are talking about the rescue of your own brother from the hands of the infidel."
"Don't call me Billy. Not ever again." William lifted his goblet and swigged the last drops of the cognac. "No, I agree that there are better names for you than that. Cheat? Twister? What else would you call the man who denies his own younger brother and goes back on an oath to his father?"
"Don't address me in that disrespectful tone." William hurled his goblet into the fireplace. It shattered. He got to his feet and advanced on Tom menacingly. "You will have to learn your place, or I will beat it into you." His face was dark with rage.
Tom stood his ground. "As you beat it into Alice," he asked bitterly. "You are a fierce, hard man when it comes to bullying servants and women, brother. You are a prince of liars when it comes to breaking your word and cheating on your sworn obligations, too."
"You little turd." William's face had turned dark red and seemed now to swell. He was no longer handsome and debonair. "You will not speak like that of my wife."
Tom had found the weakness, the way to reach and wound him. "Have a care, Billy. Alice might hit back. You would be no match for her in a fair fight. You might be reduced to beating her baby. That should give you real pleasure, turning little Francis's face purple and blue with your whip."
He was watching his man poised on his toes, his fists clenched at his sides, watching William's eyes to read his intention, ready to meet him when he attacked.
"Tom, please, Tom."
To Tom's astonishment, William's face crumpled. The anger flowed out of him and he looked distraught.
"Don't say that, please."
His shoulders sagged, and he held out his hands towards his brother in appeal.
"You are right. I owe a duty to our father's memory. We promised to set aside our differences."
He came towards Tom with his right hand outstretched.
"Here's my hand on it, Tom. Come, take it."
Tom was thrown off balance by this sudden change in William. He hesitated, but his anger and outrage were subsiding, and William was smiling at him warmly. And what he had said was true. They had promised their father. He forced himself to relax, and awkwardly he put out his own hand to take William's. His brother gripped it firmly and smiled into Tom's eyes. Then, suddenly, with all his strength, he heaved Tom towards him. At the same time, he lowered his chin and butted the top of his head into Tom's face, catching him across the bridge of the nose. Tom's vision exploded in a burst of flashing light, and he felt the cartilage in his nose crack. A wash of blood shot from both his nostrils, and he reeled backwards. But William still had a grip on his right hand, and again he pulled him forward. William was left-handed, and this was his strong side. Tom's vision was starred with fireballs of light, and he was dazed. He did not see the fist coming. It cracked into the side of his head and sent him flying backwards over the library table. The sheafs of paper on the tabletop scattered like leaves in a high wind, and Tom smashed into the floor on his shoulder blades. Though he was half-stunned, he was already scrabbling at the floorboards in an effort to get back on his feet and into the fight. But William jerked the dagger from the sheath on his hip and launched himself over the table as Tom came up on his knees. Through his fractured vision, Tom saw the glint of the blade and hooked up under it with his forearm, deflecting it from the centre of his chest where it was aimed. The point scraped over the top of his shoulder, slicing through his waistcoat. Tom barely felt the sting of the steel before William's weight hit him squarely, and they went over together, chest to chest. Tom grappled for his wrist as William tried to stab the dagger into his eye, and they rolled across the polished floorboards, just one on top of the other.
"I'll cut your liver out," William grunted, and changed the angle of his thrusts.
Tom had to rally all his scattered wits and strength to hold him off. The point of the dagger was inches from his face. Even though William had led the sedate life of a gentleman these last 3 years, his wrestling skill and muscle seemed unimpaired. They crashed into the bookcase at the end of the room. At that moment, Tom was on top, and he used the brief instant of respite to slam his brother's dagger hand into the sharp edge of one of the oak shelves. William yelped, and his grip on the hilt slackened. Tom used all his strength to repeat the blow. He saw blood springing up across William's knuckles where they hit the wood, but he did not lose the dagger. Again Tom pounded his fist against the edge of the shelf, and this time William gasped with the agony. His fingers opened, and the weapon slipped from them. Neither of them could reach for it without losing his grip on the other. For a moment they matched strength. Then Tom curled up his legs under him and started to rise. William came up with him. They were standing now chest to chest, gripping each other's wrists. William tried to swing Tom off his feet, but he stood solid. He tried again, and Tom went with the swing, using the impetus to fling William into the bookshelves. Loaded with heavy books, they reached almost to the high ceiling of the room, and William crashed into them with such force that an entire section came free of the wall and swung down on top of them. An avalanche of leather-bound volumes cascaded down on the pair, and the falling shelves gathered momentum. Anyone trapped under them would be crushed under their weight. They realized this simultaneously and sprang apart. As they scrambled aside, the shelves thundered down in a chaos of splintering wood and glass. Panting, they confronted each other over the wreckage. Blood bubbled from Tom's broken nose and dribbled down his shirt front. But his vision and strength came back to him, and with them his rage.
"You were ever the cheat, Billy. You king hit me."
He started forward, but William whirled and ran to the display of military arms hanging up upon the far wall.
There were steel shields surrounded by hundreds of edged weapons arranged in decorative patterns collected by the Courtney ancestors from every battlefield on which they'd fought. William snatched down a heavy sword that had been used by a cavalier officer in King Charles's cavalry.
"Now we will finish this once and for all," he said grimly, as he turned on Tom. He cut and thrust at the air with the long blade to test its balance and feel. Tom retreated slowly before him. He could not reach the far wall and select a weapon of his own, neither could he escape through the double doors. To do so, he would give William his chance. He thought of the dagger his brother had dropped, but that was buried under the books. With his sleeve, he wiped the blood from his face and backed away. "Ha-ha!" William shouted, and came on faster, driving at him with a rapid series of lunges. Tom was forced to jump away, twisting and dodging. William was working him towards the corner furthest from the door. Tom saw the trap, but when he tried to break out, his brother blocked him, cutting right and left at his head, forcing him back once more. Tom was evaluating his style and expertise. He saw that he had not improved since the days when he had watched him practicing with Aboli. William was still a better wrestler than a bladesman. His eyes gave away his intention, and although he was as swift as a striking adder on the thrust and the left-handed cut, he was weak on the reverse cut and tardy on the recovery from a thrust. Now he charged in suddenly, underestimating his unarmed adversary. Tom gave, with a series of quick-running steps, backwards, watching his eyes. His back came up hard against a section of bookshelf that was still standing, and he saw the triumph in William's dark eyes. "Now, sir!" He thrust high in the natural line, and Tom let him commit to the stroke before he rolled his body away from it. The thrust went under his armpit, and the blade sank into the spine of a book on the shelf behind him. Briefly, the blade was trapped, but Tom did not make the mistake of trying to wrestle it from his grip and lacerating his hands on the razor steel. While William struggled to free it, Tom stooped quickly and gathered up one of the heavy books from the floor at his feet. He hurled it into William's face. It struck him on the forehead, but as he staggered back, the blade came free. As Tom bounded past him, William struck out at him, but he was slow on his weak side and still off balance. The point touched Tom's flank and drew more blood, but it was a flesh wound, and Tom was past. He started for the wall display of weapons, but he heard the soft slither of William's stockinged feet close behind him. Instinctively he knew that William would catch him before he could get another sword down off the wall, and that he would receive a killing thrust into his unprotected back. He changed direction and heard William swear as he slipped on the polished floor. His stockings gave him no purchase. Tom reached the table and snatched up the massive silver candlestick from the centerpiece. Holding it in front of him, he whirled to face William's next charge. His brother raised the sword high and hacked at Tom's head. It was a poor stroke, one that would have been fatal folly if Tom had had a sword in his hand. Tom raised the candlestick and the blade clattered against the soft metal. He knew that the shock had jarred his brother's hand. William winced and gasped, but raised the sword to repeat the wild overarm stroke. Quicker on the recovery, Tom swung the candlestick like a battle axe into William's ribs under the raised sword. He heard a bone break, like a green stick, and William shouted with the pain. But though his aim was thrown askew, he could not stop the blow he had already launched. It hissed past Tom's head and buried itself in the tabletop, shattering the magnificently grained walnut. Tom hit him again with the candlestick, but William ducked, avoiding the full force of the blow. Still it sent him staggering back to trip on the pile of books. He almost went down, but with a wild windmill of his right arm, recovered his balance. Tom had darted away towards the door, and William went after him again, cutting left and right at his back, the blows falling just short. Tom raced for the door out into the hall, and through it saw his sword belt hanging in the alcove where Matthew had hung it for him when he entered the house. The great sapphire in the pommel flashed at him like a harbour beacon welcoming a gale-blasted ship. As he ran through the open doors, he reached out and slammed one shut in William's face. William blocked the swing of the door with his shoulder and threw it back.
but the check had given Tom just enough leeway to cross the hall and tear down his sword belt from the rack. He whirled and used the engraved and lacquered scabbard to block William's next wild thrust. He leapt back, and before William could follow up, he had drawn the steel of the blue Neptune sword out of its scabbard. The blade came clear with a soft snick and quivered in his right hand like a beam of solid sunlight. The reflections danced on the walls and the ceiling above, where he stood four square to face William on equal terms at last. William came up short as the inlaid steel weaved like a standing cobra in his face and winked gold sparks into his eyes. "Yes, brother. Now we will finish this once and for all." Tom threw William's threat back into his teeth and came forward, staring deep into his brother's dark eyes, right foot leading, taking light, rapid steps. William gave ground before his advance, and Tom saw fear bloom in his eyes. He realized what he had known all along. William was a coward. "Why should I be surprised?" he thought grimly. "Bullies are usually cowards." To test him, he attacked en flèche, the attack of the arrow, driving in a storm of rapid thrusts. William almost fell over backwards in his haste to avoid the flashing blade. "You are quick as a frightened rabbit, brother," Tom laughed in his face, but he was holding himself in check, never relaxing his vigilance. The frightened leopard is the most dangerous. There was also danger in facing a left-handed bladesman. All the coups were reversed, and he might lay himself open to the left-handed cut from William's strong side. Fortunately, Arbeli had emphasized this during so many practice sessions. Arbeli was ambidextrous, and he had often changed his sword into his left hand in the middle of a bout, shifting the symmetry of the engagement, trying to throw Tom off his stroke. In the beginning he had succeeded, but Tom had been an apt student. William stumbled and slipped, dropped to one knee. It looked natural, but Tom had seen his eyes and the way his blade had drifted back into position for the left-handed cut in the low line, a stroke that would sever Tom's Achilles tendon and cripple him. Instead of stepping into the snare, Tom jumped back and circled swiftly into his weak quarter. "You waste your talents, brother," Tom smiled through the blood of his broken nose. "You might have an illustrious career at the Globe." William was forced to scramble to his feet as Tom came in again from the right and drove him back to the foot of the grand staircase with a fierce series of cuts and thrusts, changing his angle and line with each blow. William was hard put to block each successive stroke. His breathing turned ragged and his eyes filled slowly with terror. The sweat popped out in little transparent blisters across his forehead. "Don't be afraid, Billy," Tom smiled at him over the darting steel. "It's like a razor. You will hardly feel it go in." His next thrust split open the front of William's shirt without cutting the ivory smooth skin beneath. "Just like that," Tom said. "No pain at all." William reached the staircase and whirled. He went up it with long, elastic bounds, three treads at a time. But Tom was after him, gaining with every stride. William heard him and was forced to turn to defend himself on the first landing. He reached instinctively for the dagger on his belt, but the sheath was empty. "It's gone, Billy," his brother reminded him. "No more dirty little tricks. You will have to fight with what you have." To begin with, William had the advantage of height as Tom came up from below him. He went for the overhead slash, but it was not the stroke to attempt on a bladesman of Tom's caliber. He blocked it with a dead hit and trapped the blade as he came up onto the landing to face him. They strained together, their weapons locked before their eyes. "When you're gone, Billy, the title will pass to little Francis." Tom tried not to let the strain distort his voice, but William was powerful in the shoulders, and their blades trembled and shook with the pressure each was applying. "Alice will be his guardian. She would never let Dorian down," he said, and threw William away from him with a heave of his shoulders. At the same time, he stepped back and dropped the point to the level of his brother's throat. "You see, I have to kill you, Billy, if only for Dorian's sake." And he lunged for William's throat. It was a mortal stroke, but to avoid it, William hurled himself backwards wildly. He crashed into the banisters behind him, which gave way with a splintering crackle of timbers. William fell in a tangle of limbs into the entrance hall 10 feet below. He hit the boards with a shuddering crash, and the sword flew from his grip. For a moment the wind was driven from his lungs, and he lay on his back, dazed and helpless. Tom jumped over the shattered banisters and dropped feet first, bracing himself in mid-air with cat-like grace to land lightly, breaking the force of his fall with a flexing of his legs and going down on one knee before springing up again. He kicked away William's sword, sending it skidding across the floor to the far wall. Then he stood tall over William's sprawling body. He placed the point of his blade at the base of his brother's throat, in the V of his white shirt front, where the crisp black hairs of his chest curled out of the opening. "As you said, Billy, once and for all, it's over between us," Tom told him grimly, and began the death thrust. Yet it was as though a steel manacle was holding back his sword hand. He pricked the skin at William's throat, but could not go deeper. He tried again, exerting all his strength, but a force outside himself held back the blade. He stood over William, a terrible, blood-splattered figure, the sword trembling in his hands, and his face distorted into an ugly mask by his rage and frustration. "Do it!" The voice of his resolve rang in his ears, and again he tried to stab downwards, but his right arm would not obey. "Do it! Kill him now, for Dorry's sake, if not for your own." Then the echo of his father's voice overrode the murderous command. "You are brothers. Brothers should never be enemies. I want you to forget the old disputes that have torn you apart, and for my sake become brothers in the full sense." He wanted to shout back, "I have to do this!" William lay on his back, pinned under the blade, and tears of terror filled his eyes. He opened his mouth to plead for his life, but no words came, only a dreadful croak, like the cry of a raven. Tom felt the muscles and sinews of his right hand bunching with the effort he had to make to force them to obey his will, and the point moved down an inch and pierced the soft skin. Bright blood welled up from the shallow scratch, and William squirmed.
"Please, I will give you the money, Tom," he whispered. "I swear it. This time I will give you the money." "I can never trust you again. You have broken our sacred oath. You are beyond the call of honour," Tom said, and his revulsion for his brother's cowardice and perfidy gave him the strength to carry through the dreadful deed. This time his right arm would obey.
"Tom!"
A dreadful cry rang through the silent house. For a moment Tom thought it was his mother's voice from beyond the grave. He looked up. A wraith-like figure stood at the head of the stairs, and Tom was seized by a superstitious dread. Then he saw that it was Alice with her infant in her arms.
"No, Tom, you must not kill him."
Tom wavered. "You don't understand. He is evil. You yourself know he is the very devil.
He is my husband and Francis's father. Don't do it, Tom, for my sake."
"Both you and the baby will be better off with his death." Tom turned his attention back to the creature who lay craven and whimpering at his feet.
"It's murder, Tom. They will hunt you down wherever you run, and they will find you and drag you to the scaffold."
"I don't care," Tom said, and meant it.
"Without you, there will be nobody to go to Dorian. For his sake, if not for mine, you must not do this evil thing."
The truth of what she said struck Tom like a blow in the face, and he flinched at the sting of it. Then he stepped back.
"Go,"
he ordered, and William scrambled to his feet. Tom saw there was no fight left in him.
"Get out of my sight."
His voice was thick with disgust. "And remember, next time you raise your hand to your wife, that she saved your life this day." William backed away to the stairs, and then when he was at a safe distance, he turned, ran up them, and disappeared down the long gallery.
"Thank you, Tom."
Alice looked down at him with tragic eyes.
"You and I will live to regret this," Tom told her.
"That is in God's hands."
"I have to go away," Tom said. "I cannot stay here to protect you."
"I know that."
Her voice was a resigned whisper.
"I shall never return to High Weald," he went on doggedly.
"I know that also."
she agreed. Go with God, Tom. You are a good man, as your father was. She turned and vanished around the corner of the gallery. Tom stood for a while, considering the enormity of what he had just said. He would never return to High Weald. When he was dead, he would not lie in the vault of the chapel on the hill with his ancestors. His grave would be in a far and wild land. He shivered at the knowledge. Then he stooped to gather up his sword belt and scabbard where he had dropped them. He strapped the Neptune sword around his waist. He looked through the doors into the library. His papers were scattered over the floor. He went into the old room and was about to gather them up when he stopped himself. There will be no call for those now, he thought darkly. Slowly he looked around the room. It was filled with wonderful memories of his father. Another tie with his childhood would part here. Then his eye fell on the row of his father's journals on the shelf beside the door, the faithful record of all Hal's voyages. Each page, written in his hand, contained sailing directions and information more valuable than any other item in the house Tom was leaving forever. That much I will take with me, he thought. He swept them off the shelves and went out into the hall. Evan, the house steward, and two of the footmen were waiting there. Evan had a cocked pistol in each hand. His lordship has sent for the sheriff's men. He has ordered me to detain you until he arrives, Master Tom. So what are you going to do, Evan? Tom laid his hand on the hilt of his sword. Your horse is waiting outside, Master Tom. Evan lowered the pistols. I hope you find Master Dorian. All of us at High Weald will miss you. Come back to us one day. Goodbye, Evan. Tom's voice was gruff. Thank you. He went down the steps, put the journals into his saddlebags, and sprang up into the saddle. He turned the horse's head towards the sea and rode down the long gravel drive. At the gates, he resisted the urge to look back. It's over, he told himself. It's all over. And he spurred on down the dark road. Tom decided not to wait for the sheriff's men to come for him with the charges he knew William would trump up. He found his men in the taproom of the Royal Oak. They stared in astonishment at his blood-stained clothing and broken nose. We will sail immediately, he told Aberley, Ned Tyler, and Alf Wilson. Then he looked across at Luke Jarvis on the far side of the fireplace. Luke owned the tiny raven and was his own man, but he nodded his acceptance of the order without demur. When they were about to slip the lines from the dock, a lone horseman came pounding down Plymouth Hoe at the gallop. He almost fell over the horse's neck as he reined in. Wait for me, sir! Tom smiled as he recognised Master Walsh's voice. You cannot leave me behind! A small group of the old stalwarts gathered on the open deck as the raven slipped out into the night sea. What course, sir? Luke asked as they cleared the headland. Tom looked longingly towards the south. Down there lay Good Hope and the gateway to the Orient. Oh, for a ship! A real ship and not this cockle-shell, he thought, then turned firmly from that direction. London, he said. His voice was blurred, for his nose was swollen and blocked. I will pay you for this voyage, he added. He still had most of his prize money in Samuel's bank in London. We will settle that later, Luke grunted, then shouted the order to his three-man crew to tack the little cutter onto an easterly heading. The Raven slipped quietly up the Thames and into the Pool of London, drawing no attention in the busy throng of small craft. Luke set them ashore with their meagre baggage on the stone wharf below the Tower of London. Aberley found cheap lodgings in the mean streets alongside the river. If fortune favours, we will need these rooms for only a few days, Tom looked around the dingy wooden shack. We will need good fortune to survive the rats and cockroaches, Alf Wilson remarked, while Tom changed into the best clothes he had brought with him. The dark blue coat and breeches, not too fancy, gave him a sober, business-like appearance. I will go with you, Clebby, Aberley volunteered. You will probably lose your way without me.
The day was cold and rainy, a forerunner of autumn. It was a long walk through the maze of narrow streets, but Abberley threaded his way through them as unerringly as if they had been his native forests. They came out at the Cornhill end of Leadenhall Street and crossed to the imposing façade of the company headquarters.
"I will wait for you at the tavern on the corner," Abberley told Tom as they parted.
When he entered the foyer of the building, one of the secretaries recognized Tom and greeted him respectfully.
"I'll see if his lordship will receive you," he said. "In the meantime, will you wait in the parlour, Mr. Courtney?"
A uniformed footman took Tom's boat cloak and brought him a glass of Madeira. While he sat in an easy chair before the crackling fire, Tom rehearsed the appeal he intended to put to Nicholas Childs. He could be reasonably certain that Childs had not yet heard from Brother William. Unless he had become clairvoyant, William would not expect him to call here, so he was unlikely to have sent an urgent message to Childs to warn him not to offer Tom assistance. On the other hand, Tom had realized the futility of asking Childs for command of a company ship. There were many captains of vast experience and long service who would take precedence over him. Tom had never had his own full command, and Childs would never give him one of the magnificent Indiamen. The best he could expect was a berth as a junior officer on a ship bound for India, and Dorian was in Africa. As he turned the problem over, Tom frowned into the fire and sipped his wine. Lord Childs knew all about Dorian's capture. In fact, Tom had heard him discussing it with Hal when they were guests at Bombay House. If Tom asked for a ship, he would realize his intention of going after his captured brother instead of trading for profit. Furthermore, if Tom procured any other vessel, Childs would do his best to prevent him ever rounding the Cape. Hal had said that the company was bitterly opposed to interlopers in their chartered territories. "No, best to feign disinterest in that part of the world. I'll take the skin off this cat from the tail end," he decided grimly. Lord Childs kept him waiting less than an hour, which Tom took as a mark of high favour. The chairman of the board of the East India Company was probably one of the busiest men in London, and Tom had arrived without invitation or warning. On the other hand, I am a brother knight of the order, and my family owns 7% of the shares of the company. He cannot guess that only days ago I came close to slitting Billy's throat. The secretary led him up the main staircase and through the antechamber to Child's office. The furnishings bespoke the company's vast wealth and circumstance. The carpets underfoot were of lustrous silk, and the paintings that hung upon the panelled walls were imposing seascapes depicting the ships of the company in full sail off the exotic shores of the Carnatic and Coromandel coasts. When Tom passed under a chandelier that looked like an inverted ice mountain and entered the inner chamber through carved and gilt doors, Lord Childs rose from his desk and came to meet him. This was enough to allay any misgivings that Tom still might have about his reception.
"My dear young Thomas,"
Childs clasped his hand, and with thumb and forefinger gave him the recognition grip of Brother Knights of the Order.
"This is a pleasant surprise."
Tom gave him the countersign.
"My lord, it is gracious of you to receive me at such short notice."
Childs made a deprecatory gesture.
"Not at all. I'm only sorry that I was forced to make you wait. The Dutch ambassador," he shrugged. "I'm sure you understand."
Childs wore a full wig and the Star of the Garter on his gold-embroidered lapels.
"How is your dear brother William?"
"In the best of health, my lord. He asked me to convey his deepest respects."
"I was most sad not to be able to attend your father's funeral, but Plymouth is so far from London."
Childs led Tom to a chair below the tall windows that looked out over the rooftops to a distant view of the river and its shipping.
"A remarkable man, your father. He will be greatly missed by all of us who knew him well,"